Welcome back to The Realignment. I'm Sagar Njeti.
And I'm Marshall Kozlov. This is your first time joining us. Be sure to go back and listen to the trailer and episode one to learn more about the issues we're exploring on the show.
Our guest today hardly needs an introduction. George Will has spent more than four decades at the forefront of American politics. He's been writing Pulitzer Prize-winning columns, frequently appearing on television, and writing numerous books.
His latest bestseller is The Conservative Sensibility, which aims to articulate a timeless vision for how conservative policymakers should think about the problems of today. His vision stands in stark contrast to the current trajectory of the conservative movement, especially following the 2016 elections.
We sat down with him to see how his vision answers today's emerging policy questions and dilemmas, including trade, China, the role of government in crafting economic policy, and technology. Let's get into it. Great, Marshall, you ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
George Will, many consider an American institution in his own right, is joining us now to discuss his new book, The Conservative Sensibility. Mr. Will, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
So, sir, we think America is in the midst of a political realignment, basically on the level of FDR's New Deal in 1932 and the Reagan Revolution in 1980.
And I think you famously said that Barry Goldwater actually won the 1964 election, just took 16 years, because the Republican Party of 1980 was much more Southern, also was much more present in the Sun Belt, so the actual coalition had changed. So what do you think are the ingredients for a political realignment?
I don't think they exist at the moment. We're going to find out an awful lot more by the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November 2020.
Yeah, just, you know, despite the discord that we see on the Democratic side, there is still a realignment going on within the Republican Party and with the right. A lot of the conventional wisdom and the assumptions that you could hold to provide a useful framework, foreign and domestic policy issues, they just don't make any sense if you see what Republicans are up to. Mostly because the political coalitions that have defined the last couple of decades are all shifting. So this podcast in particular, we're very interested in exploring the intersection of technology, geopolitical competition with China, national security, and economics through this particular framework.
And what we came across was an anecdote of Margaret Thatcher in 1975, where she was contemplating, along with other members of Parliament, how the Conservative Party could take back power. And you actually tell it as some member was just going on about centrism and other ways you could accommodate, at which point she reaches into her handbag, grabs a copy of the Constitution of Liberty, slams it down, and says, this is what we believe. So you've actually said you want this book, The Conservative Sensibility, to fill a similar role today.
Yes, I want it slammed on a table by a president.
So, George, to this point, if you're a conservative MP, you're a lawmaker today, the people that we're going to talk to on the show, they're confronting a rule-breaking China in the free trade system. They're confronting rapid, escalating algorithmic technological change, questions over the individual and atomized society. What do they look for in the conservative sensibility to answer the pressing questions that their constituents are demanding of them?
It seems to me the first virtue in politics is to be able to tell your constituents that there's certain things they can't have because it's not good for them, or they can't have because government doesn't know how to do it. Take health care. American people are reasonably concerned about escalating health care costs. But this is 18% of the American economy. We have attached our most rapidly growing portion of our population, the elderly, to our most dynamic science, which is medicine, as an entitlement. And we have no idea how to deal with these complexities. It's like a Calder mobile. If you jiggle something here on one side, things on the other side move. That's why when you ask the American people, would you like to have Medicare for all? They say, yeah, that polls very well. Then you say, oh, by the way, it means the end of private health insurance and support for it collapses. It's all about trade-offs, and it's all about beginning to understand that when you do comprehensive reform, you're in trouble. We need sort of more bite-sized management. For example, the best thing we could do to begin nibbling away at the problem of health care is health savings accounts, in my judgment. That is where you buy high deductible insurance and you become eligible for tax-preferred savings, out of which you pay your everyday health expenses. No one expects your car insurance to pay for your windshield wipers or your oil changes. And by giving Americans skin in the game, you will turn them into cost-conscious people who, first of all, will shop for their care, but also will begin to think, there is no free lunch here, and maybe I ought to prevent some of the health care problems. I mean, enormous portion of America's health care bill is voluntary. That is, it's the result of known risky behavior. That's one way of marshaling incentives and information in a conservative way.
So what's interesting with your point about the declining faith in government as government has expanded post Great Society, but the size of government and frankly demands of government have also increased as well too. So how do you explain the fact that people believe less in the efficacy of their government, but they still ask for more?
Partly because they're not being forced to pay the full cost of it. Much more alarmed am I by the consensus in America than I am by the discord. Mm-hmm. The discord's real enough, but it's often about status and culture and felt grievances about condescension. The real alarming consensus in America is as broad as the Republic and deep as the Grand Canyon, and it is that we should have a large, more generous, as you say, ever more generous entitlement state and not pay for it. We should give the American people a dollar's worth of government and charge them 80 cents for it. The public loves that. And it is a fundamental inversion of the American governing ethic. It used to be we borrowed money for the future. We fought wars for the future, built roads, highways, dams, airports for the future. Now we're borrowing from the future to finance current consumption of government goods and services, which is an astonishingly decadent way to run a country. But everyone has agreed on it, Republicans and Democrats alike. I think the political class is more united by class interests, that is, careerism in politics, than it is divided by philosophy.
Hmm. What helps you determine which of the discord-related issues are sort of, like you said, about envy, condescension, and about deeper issues? So, and I think an example of this would be the debate over big tech and conservatism. The debate over whether tech platforms such as Facebook and Google are marginalizing conservatives, because on one level, you're right. Like there's conflict over the fact that these companies are run by university graduate liberals in blue states. There's no conservative Facebook, obviously. So there's a culture war implication, but there's also a deep implication in the nature of the internet. So how does your approach impact that sort of issue?
Well, first of all, you understand that when you say, well, the government, we hate to do this, but the government should step in. First thing you need to do is understand public choice theory, which is that the government is never neutral. Mm-hmm. Public choice theory, reduced to its essence, is that in the private sector, individuals act to maximize something, usually wealth. In the public sector, individuals act to maximize their power. This is the beginning of the deromanticizing government. So when you say the government should step in here, understand that the government is not disinterested. It never is disinterested. So whether or not you're worried about regulatory capture by a particular interest group or a particular industry or a particular company, the law of unintended consequences is going to take over.
So you told me in a previous interview we did that one of the biggest problems that you see in our society is flinching at economic dynamism. What do you mean by flinching?
I mean, I think Americans have made a choice they don't recognize. That is, when they made enormous promises to themselves in future calls on American wealth through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, they committed themselves to an economic dynamism to throw off the revenues that are going to pay the bills for all this. But it's a basic rule of moral reasoning that if you will the end, you must will the means to that end. They've willed the end, but now they think the means may be just too exhausting, that economic dynamism was all right once, but it's now too stressful. The creative destruction is creative, but it also is destruction. The frictions and uncertainties become frightening. And Americans, a lot of them would say, let's stop. Stop the world we want to get off. Too late.
So the phrase, though, is flinch, right? Which flinch suggests to me that it doesn't mean you can't continue with economic dynamism, but it does suggest a hint of caution. I think an example of this would be the issue of admitting China into the international trading system, especially in 2000, when the idea was, in talking about humility, the idea was that by liberalizing economically, China would also liberalize politically, and they would compete, play by the rules, but that didn't happen. So is there a sort of better line between is there a step before flinching that would sort of help our policy choices then?
But do a thought experiment. Suppose China were well-behaved, and suppose that India were well-behaved, as it largely is. Would the American mood about free trade and about economic dynamism be any different? I don't think so. I think what was coming to America was a reckoning with the fact that American post-war policy has succeeded. That is, we've now brought these nations into prosperity, into the world labor market, and it's not as restful. It was much more restful when the United States ruled a world in which most productive capacity had been destroyed by the war. Mm-hmm. And so we set about, through the Marshall Plan and other means, to get the world back on its feet. Well, it turns out the world back on its feet is a competitor. It's also a consumer of American goods, but a competitor also. And I think Americans feel that this is not, that somehow this surprised them.
But why, George, should we acquiesce to the rise of a Chinese middle class, which some people say is at the expense of our own? Why should we just give in to China being able to exploit the international trade system, break its own rules, protect its own economy, and exploit the domestic one here at home?
It ought to obey the rules, but the idea that a Chinese middle class exists at our expense suggests that the world economy is a zero-sum game, which it's not. The world economy is a constantly growing miracle that has, in the last 30 or 40 years, lifted 3 and 4 billion people out of subsistence living. So the idea that this is an inherent contradiction between their desires and ours is just factually and economically false.
So what does the framework that you provide us give to a policymaker, to anybody in the White House who would pick this book up and say, this is how I approach China today?
You approach China by saying the rules are only rules if they're obeyed. So obviously you have to have an enforcement mechanism. And to the extent that China will not abide by it, there have to be penalties. I understand that. But that's arguing at the margins of the great phenomenon. The great phenomenon is the latest chapter of the great enrichment, to use Deirdre McCloskey's wonderful term, the great enrichment that began first in Holland and then jumped the English Channel to Great Britain in the end of the 18th century. And it took off again at great enrichment 2.0, if you will, after the Second World War. Again, China developing a huge middle class is a triumph of American policy. Now, you're quite right to say we made a wager, both parties did, Republicans and Democrats alike, after Nixon went to China in 72, we made the great wager that economic liberalization was incompatible with, and economic dynamism was incompatible with authoritarian government. We were wrong. The Starbucks theory was wrong. The Starbucks theory was, give the Chinese a choice of 20 coffees and they'll want at least two parties. Didn't work out.
So when you're talking about actual, firstly to the question of when China violates the rules, aren't those tariffs? What's the enforcement mechanism for China not participating and acting by the rules of the global economic order?
Well, tariffs could be penalties to get them to conform to better behavior. The problem is that the administration thinks tariffs are good in themselves. Second, tariffs are an extraordinarily blunt instrument. Protectionism has been well described as blockading your own ports. I do not see why punishing American consumers for China's bad behavior is in our national interest.
So one thing I find interesting on this China point is that the response to the Cold War was anything but spontaneous. And if we are to accept China as a peer competitor, then why would it not make sense to sponsor a similar national, industrial, all-encompassing strategic effort in order to keep America competitive into the next century?
An industrial policy?
Well, any policy.
Some would call it that.
Right, yeah.
We didn't need an industrial policy to win the Cold War.
But we did have a space program, and we had national defense programs, which
Bell
subsidized
Labs.
Bell Labs. Huge American companies, which were boosted by American defense spending.
Boosted by American defense spending. There's no question the government ought to be tremendously concerned with research and development. I mean, one of the crown jewels of American civilization are our research universities. Clearly, the government has been doing this since Henry Clay's American system. Mm-hmm. The idea that it is the government's job, and I have a whole chapter in the book on political economy, stressing the adjective. It is political economy. That's what Adam Smith called it when he invented the subject, essentially, with The Wealth of Nations in the Resonant Ear of 1776, that the federal government has a role to play in providing the intellectual as well as physical infrastructure of individual striving. But it is perhaps a short step, but a perilous step, to go from this to industrial policy, to, again, the fatal conceit that government can plan an economy.
So here's an example of applying this, the framework of the book, to an issue. So if you are a young member of Congress, you are looking at the fact that China is pursuing the Made in 2025 policy, which is a plan to develop and compete with the United States in high-value industries. So you're not trying to win by offering cheap labor. You're trying to compete with the construction of airplanes, other sort of high-tech things. Why is the wrong response then industrial policy? Because you could argue in the abstract that it's wrong. You could argue in the abstract the theoretical basis, but you're forced to decide right here and now that you should or shouldn't do something with it.
Well, if government is, industrial policy is definitionally government picking winners and losers. Mm-hmm. It is government for looking down the road into the future. Governments are terrible at that. I'll give you an example. By 2007, there were billions of cell phones in the world and people liked them. Then in 2008, along came the smartphone, and everyone was unhappy with their cell phones because they wanted a smartphone. I don't know what the next one will be, but I damn well know the government doesn't know. Mm-hmm. That you want the free workings of individual genius and market forces and not have government stepping in, because government is inevitably a defender of the status quo.
So
it is a defender of existing interests against competition. That's what government is inherently reactionary.
But let's take steel, for example. You know, without the steel tariffs, prior to the steel tariffs, there was a danger that we were going to lose access to high-quality steel that we use for American defense purposes.
I disagree with that.
Well, this was the administration's
view. I know, it's what the administration said. So they said we must stop getting these unreasonably cheap national security materials from dangerous countries like Canada. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that we were losing a strategic resource to dangerous countries is preposterous.
I think it was that we didn't have native capacity to produce a strategic resource. And from a national security perspective, that was intolerable to our defense supply chain. So, is it okay then to leave it to the market to make it so
yes.
that we don't have it?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
And certainly a burden, a heavy burden of proof is on the administration. Mm-hmm. In one of the trials in a New York trade court, the judge finally asked the administration, if the president declared peanut butter a national security material, could he? And the government lawyer said, well, yes, because this, under our presidential system, where presidents are everything and can do anything, a president indeed could say peanut butter is a national security matter. But the idea that the United States was in jeopardy because it was getting steel and aluminum from Canada and from Mexico and from a number of other militarily allied nations is facially preposterous.
I want to go to the back to your cell phone example, because it's a good pivot into technology. Do you think all technological change is good?
I don't know quite how to answer that. I mean, I suppose mustard gas was a new technology in its day. And I rather wish the atom could not be split. The world would be safer. But yes, on balance, technology is good. Technology is applied science. That's all it is. And I don't know how to have a rule that says science is good except when. What?
So I think, okay, so here's an example of this. There's Ryan Sager could actually speak to this because he's interested in it. There's a backlash against the way that smartphones in various ways are addictive. They socially atomize people. There's all sorts of...
they connected people.
That was a narrative.
They do. So at the expense of connection, we have some of the smartest minds in the world working in Silicon Valley to algorithmically addict people, particularly children, to their phones. Is that something the government should concern itself with? And is there a market correction for that?
Well, A, it's something parents should concern themselves
with.
I mean, it's child behavior. And the government's role in that is approximately zero, in my judgment. I think when we use the term addiction, by the way, I'm wary of medicalizing political arguments and policy arguments. People are too much on their cell phones, but I don't want to call that a chemical addiction.
Right.
An addiction exists when the brain chemistry creates it, and I'm not sure that's happening. But again, the answer is shut your phone off.
Yeah.
And tell the children to shut their phones off.
So separate from the government intervention, because obviously we're not proposing the government take phones away from children, I think if we're looking at why American society has turned away from dynamism, it's a feeling that the individual is facing forces that are so much greater than themselves that it's almost an unreasonable burden to expect every single parent in this country, regardless of their social circumstance, to put away the phones, do all these sort of things when they have all of their own individual problems in their lives.
Are you telling me that Americans today, in our fat, sassy, and unimaginably 50 years ago rich country, are too stressed and busy to parent? I mean, this way lies a kind of constant tendency toward dependency on the state. I mean, you describe an America in a semi-dystopian way.
Well, I think
houses are busy, bigger, our incomes are higher, our diets are better, our health is better. Things are better in almost every particular than they were 50 years ago.
Then why do we have an epidemic of loneliness, suicide, opioid epidemic? It seems that on a deeper level, so yes, from an empirical perspective, materially, why hasn't our sort of, I hate to say spiritual, but almost our
spirit. Well, you're going to have to say spiritual.
Yeah.
The way you're going here.
but why do we have all of these sort of like deep social problems?
For the same reason we had an alcohol epidemic in this country at the turn of the 20th century, when we had an enormous movement of people off the farms and into the cities, where they had left the rootedness of small communities in rural America and were rootless, deracinated, to use the sociologist's favorite terms, in urban America. And it took a while to develop the institutions of civil society in urban settings to cope with this. But we've seen this before.
So here's what's...
And no one, it seems to me, thinks, well, then on balance, because of the alcoholism and all the rest, on balance, leaving the farm was not such a good idea. Leaving the farm was a terrific idea.
Well, I think this is particularly interesting because you wrote an entire book many years ago, Statecraft is Soulcraft, in which you advocated for government concerning itself with the moral lives of its citizens. So what's changed in the interim years in order to shift you towards this view?
Well, the book Statecraft is Soulcraft, read by dozens, had as its
including two here.
The subtitle was more important than the title. The subtitle is What Government Does, not what it should do, but what it cannot help but do. My argument was any government, by establishing a legal regime for economic and commercial life, is going to shape the souls of its people. We had this argument. It was the first great American argument was about this. It was Federalists against the Anti-Federalists in a way, but it was also Hamilton against Jefferson. Jefferson said, what we want is a vast country, hence I'll expand presidential powers and make the Louisiana Purchase so that we can have rooted, independent, rural yeomen with the values of Thomas Jefferson. And Alexander Hamilton said, no, no, we want urban, restless, entrepreneurial, upwardly mobile, striving people, rather like Alexander Hamilton. So we've had this argument throughout our history. What kind of people were we going to be? In Statecraft to Soulcraft, I was insufficiently sensitive to and aware of the fact that capitalism, a market society, is soulcraft. Mm-hmm. It reduces dependency. It reduces the tendency, I say, looking at one of my interlocutors here, to say, my child is addicted to a phone. What can the government do about this? How about go to bed and don't have dessert?
So this is interesting, though, because I want to return to the discussion of alcoholism at the turn of the 20th century, because look at Theodore Roosevelt. He intervened with alcohol in a couple of different ways. There was the controversy with him banning the sale of alcohol during the weekends, which caused a lot of controversy in the, you know, German American community. We had prohibition.
Yeah, if I could interrupt
years,
you, yeah, please. Because it didn't ban alcohol from Teddy Roosevelt and his friends. That was all the good government, upper class, Protestant reformers,
right,
who were perfectly free to drink at home. It was the German immigrants and the Irish and Italian immigrants who weren't free to go to their pubs and cafes on the weekend. So this was a classic case of the, A, legislating for other people's inconvenience and doing so for their own good while not suffering any of the burdens yourself.
But that's still to say, though, with the government, we can't just simply say that, you know, we had a problem with alcohol consumption at the turn of the 20th century, and then it sort of went away through just sort of spontaneous order. It wasn't spontaneous, right? If you German and Irish immigrants, that was a question of the immigration into this country. And the balance, obviously, towards the 20th century, it turns much more towards Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean. You then have Prohibition 15 years later. It seems hard for me to untangle the history of alcohol in the 20th century from government action, whether or not that action was good or not.
Oh, there's not, yeah. no question government has influenced alcohol policy. It still does.
Mm-hmm.
but by the way, prohibition as a public health measure worked. That is, there were fewer alcohol-related diseases during prohibition.
Mm-hmm. So
the public cost of the rule of law and other also important matters was steep.
Well, we're looking at this in particular. There's a current national debate about marijuana. I think we have 11 states now that have legalized marijuana. But something we talk a lot about on this podcast are the possible extraneous problems with the legalization. We've seen teen use go up. We've seen doctors are warning about the extraneous effects on there. How would you approach the legalization of marijuana and the government's role in regulating it and protecting the safety of children?
One of the best things government does, one of the most cost-efficient things it does, is distribute public health information to an information-acquiring middle-class nation.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from AIDS to seatbelts to cholesterol, it works. 50 years ago, half the American adult population woke up in the morning and lit a cigarette. Doesn't do that anymore, and government did this. Surgeon General's ruling in 64 that cigarettes are carcinogens.
Right.
So that works. And the government ought to sponsor the research through the National Health Service and others into the effects, particularly on adolescent brains, of marijuana. That's a perfectly sensible role for government and for distributing the results of that.
So when you look at, particularly with the legalization of marijuana, you are advocating for government public health problems, for government identification of a problem and public health distribution of a problem.
Conservatism is not hostile to ameliorative government.
Right.
And it's not hostile to information. And it's not hostile to gathering facts and data. Of course not. It's not high on the conservative agenda to abolish the National Institutes of Health or the Centers for Disease Control. These are parts of the infrastructure of a complex society.
What about the question of legalization itself?
That, it seems to me, is something that at this stage in our knowledge can reasonably be left to the states. Let's have an experiment in Colorado. It won't be quite tightly confined within the borders of Colorado, but close enough. When Brandeis described the states as laboratories of liberty, this is a laboratory. We're going to find out what happens to driving accidents. What happens to teenagers and their homework when you have legalized marijuana? These are factual questions, and we're going to get some data.
We wanted to take a second to tell you a little bit about Hudson Institute.
For nearly 60 years, Hudson Institute has challenged conventional thinking and influenced public policymakers and global leaders in government and business in areas of defense, economics, international relations, healthcare, technology, and law. From managing strategic transitions from our allies to identifying threats abroad from our adversaries, Hudson is committed to promoting American leadership and global engagement for a secure, free, and prosperous future.
You can find all of Hudson's research by visiting Hudson.org or by following us on social media using @HudsonInstitute. Without much further ado, let's jump back into the second half of our interview with George Will. I think what's interesting here is that it seems to me, thinking of why is it that we're going to have to wait a bit for a conservative president to slam this book down, is that there is a deep lack of faith in the future. Because your point about dynamism is, you know, yes, there's a dynamic economy, but if you're looking in the 19th century, after the frontier, there's San Francisco and there's Los Angeles and there's the boom of the 20th century. What do you think is necessary, and what would you advise a politician reading your book? What do they need to articulate to help restore people's broader faith in the future, or at least within the movement?
They ought to articulate, first of all, the stunning success of the American economy. The greatest anti-poverty program in the history of the world is capitalism. The greatest successful application of this organization called capitalism is the United States economy. Americans, democracies in general, I think, are subject to social hypochondria. Mm-hmm. And Americans certainly are. Oh, woe is us. And people are absolutely staggered when you tell them, by the way, do you know what the average size of a house was 50 years ago? And how much bigger your house is. And you go down the list, all the enormous achievements of the American, say, healthcare system, and acquaint people with the facts. That's the first job of a leader, is not to tell them about the future, it's to tell them about the present, and the present in relation to the past. In 1900, the American people spent twice as much money on funeral as they did on healthcare. In 1900, 37% of all deaths were from infectious diseases. Today it's 2%. In 1900, 17% of deaths were people over 65. Today it's 75%. Things are getting better faster than ever. And someone has to tell people the bad news, which is that the news is good.
So I think this goes to, I've heard this argument from you, from Steven Pinker, and many others, that you know things actually are better now than they have ever before in human history. But what Marshall gets to in his question earlier was that there seems to be a deep cultural malaise at the heart of our individuals. So when it comes to the generation of institutions in this country, do you think that institutions, civil institutions, civic institutions, can regenerate spontaneously in this atomized society that we currently live in?
In the first place, I want to live in an atomized society. That is, I want to live in a society of individuals who think of themselves as individuals, not as members of a cohort or some other identity group, some kind of tribalism. Second, before we postulate that there is this widespread malaise, let's find out if it's true. Mm-hmm. There is, to use your phrase of a moment ago, an epidemic of opioids, but the vast majority of Americans are not taking opioids. This is not a pandemic. This is not the Spanish flu.
Yes.
That was a serious epidemic.
Globally.
Yeah. I mean, this is, again, these are problems in a big country, has big problems, but they're also transitory and they can be combated, and they are not judgments against the society. You talk about the institutions of civil society. What was it, 30, 40 years ago that Putnam at Harvard published Bowling Alone?
That's right.
And he began this enormously interesting argument about whether or not Americans were bowling alone. That is, the bowling leagues had disappeared and rootless, deracinated individuals were in their loneliness, whatever they were doing, playing video games. They were not bowling together. Well, a lot of people said it was actually not true. That depends on how you measure this. But I'm far from convinced that the institutions of civil society, churches, synagogues, service organizations, are no longer performing as they once did.
So here's an example of an institution that isn't performing well. You've been at the Washington Post for since the 1970s, I believe. Journalism, in the sense that the business model that provided for money, advertising, has disappeared.
Yeah.
Which occurs when a dynamic invention, the cell phone, the internet, when Google and Facebook create the greatest advertising business the world's ever seen, it instantly becomes clear that you shouldn't be spending advertising money in your local paper. Now, I could totally believe that in 15 years, there's going to be a dynamic, strong business model for journalism, especially on the local level. But how do we navigate that 10, 15-year period?
Beats me, but we're going to find out. I don't know the future. That's the point. Look, if newspapers were to disappear, there'd be a reason for that, the fundamental being that there was no longer demand for them. Now, what would people be doing instead of demanding newspapers? I get up in the morning, and I click on my phone, and I read the aggregators. Mm-hmm. Real Clear Politics, Real Clear Defense, Real Clear World, Real Clear Markets, Real Clear Sports. Someone's doing an awful lot of writing because I'm reading it.
But they're not producing it. But the aggregators aren't producing the journalism. And actually, part of the issue is that Real Clear Politics will take the links to articles done by actual expensive journalists on the ground and then post them on their sites and get the ad revenue, or at least a large portion of it. So that's the difficulty.
But someone's still writing the stuff, and it keeps appearing. And I do not pretend to have the ability to peer over the horizon and tell you what this is going to be like 10 years from now, any more than I could imagine a market for new Coke. I mean, people get these things
which
wrong.
Is coming back, weirdly enough.
I find this really interesting because we look at places like Chicago or like Cook County. Someone took a photo of the Cook County press room, and there's nobody left inside because nobody can afford that. So there's no demand for it. But there was an inherent good to just having some 10 scrappy reporters rolling around the courthouse.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But how do we solve for that? Or should we even solve for that? And I think the answer is no.
Is it
a public good?
It's certainly not a public good in the sense that, I mean, we have a corporation for public broadcasting. Are you suggesting we should have a corporation for public newspapers?
Maybe we should, for local news.
Lord.
Yeah.
Why? Why shouldn't
government go into the journalism business? I can think of some reasons.
Absolutely. I think it's more, if maybe not you even want government-sponsored, maybe it's not government-sponsored program, but it's more about how do we prop up these civic institutions and provide accountability.
If the absence of demand for this service is what requires them to be propped up, maybe the absence of demand is important to note here. Mm-hmm. I mean, if newspapers are disappearing because people don't want them, why is it incumbent on the government to give people things are indicating they don't want?
Right. I think the real question there is just, I don't think anybody ever wanted necessarily deep investigative dives into a Cook County official at the courthouse, but the mere fact that it existed was a check and a balance on the system. And so without that sort of public check, what is it as a society that we can look to making sure who's keeping our civic institutions accountable?
But you see, you're assuming that when newspapers, as we have traditionally known them, become anemic and perhaps disappear. It's premature to...
It is.
You know, I think Orwell once said that intellectuals are in the business of discerning trends, and they become attached to their trends. And he said that's like saying Rommel got to Alexandria, therefore Rommel will get to Cairo.
Yeah.
Trends are trends until they stop being trends. And again, little epistemic humility here. I don't know what comes next. You were worrying about Facebook?
I'm worried about Facebook in the sense
that... Do you remember MySpace?
MySpace wasn't a great advertising company. No. But I mean, that's actually part of the issue. If there was a competitive MySpace, Facebook wouldn't be able to hoover up as much of the ad spend as they do now. That's the discussion.
Rupert Murdoch thought that MySpace was the wave of the future.
He did.
He was mistaken.
He was very wrong, yeah.
Because not even Rupert Murdoch knows the future.
I think it's an interesting question here on Facebook and Google, because this is another very emerging question on the new right. We have people like Senator Josh Hawley. They're talking about breaking up big technology companies. I've heard you say in the past you're okay with antitrust legislation or antitrust actions as an enforcement and the keeping of an honest market. Where do you look at these big social media companies and whether they should be broken up?
Well, first of all, suppose that instead of dealing with the stuff that Facebook deals with, suppose we were talking about a comparable domination of the market for salt and protein, mm-hmm. things people really need. There's a way in which we don't need Facebook the way we need salt and protein. So then you have to say, well, okay, how is the scale of Facebook or of Google harming consumers? Now, the traditional antitrust concern has been the consumer. People say, well, that's not good enough. Hawley says, that's not good enough. Mm. Well, what next? Give me your criterion for why the government ought to step in and break up what public appetite and entrepreneurial skill has created.
The question is power, right? Because if you're looking at why I think the Constitution of Liberties framework isn't quite applicable in every case, it's that you have these massive companies who are capable of using their economic power, fueled by the fact that software is growing at an exponential rate in terms of its dynamism. These corporations, and I want to say these social media companies are able to influence elections. They are able to change entire industries at the flip of a switch.
Hold on a second. Give me an example of how they influence elections.
Well, so Facebook, for example, by just promoting Get Out to Vote, can reach a population larger than any single other candidate. So if they were to hyper-target their ads, which they have as a right to do, they can suppress any speech or any candidate or push any political viewpoint. They could change the outcome of the election. Now, there's nothing prohibiting from them from doing that.
I understand. Yeah. Power. Let's define power as the ability to achieve intended effects.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That distinguishes a bull in a china shop. He has effects, but they're not intended effects.
Yes.
Okay, now tell me the power Facebook wields.
So, for example, Facebook, frankly, has the influence. No, Facebook is the biggest publisher in this country.
It's big. Big's not a synonym for power. Tell me the power they have.
So, okay, perfect example. To Sagar's point about the election influence, the example he's giving is that Facebook has done studies that reveal the fact that when Facebook looks at a congressional district and targets just generic, go out to vote, voting's great. Like it has a statistical impact on turnout. So maybe it's not the fact that they are doing these things, it's the fact that they have the potential to it. And that if we could say that a big, unlimited government of the, you know, Woodrow Wilsonian type or the Teddy Roosevelt type is a threat or could do things badly, I think conservatives need to add tech to that similar framework.
But you see, when the trust busters went after the Sugar Trust and Standard Oil, they didn't say we're going after Standard Oil because it might do something. They went after Standard Oil because it had done something. It seemed to me radically different to say the government should go after something on the potential that it might do something wrong.
Well, I mean, what Hollywood would counter and the people who agree with him would say, well, Facebook's merging of WhatsApp and of Instagram has created the world's largest repository of data, particularly on American citizens, that some of this data is not being properly handled, which is why they've been fined by the FTC and by the European Commission.
How did it get that data?
Well, yeah, it provided a product in which people voluntarily gave it to him. I don't think there is no debate over that.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so I guess in your view, is it that because it was a voluntary contract between the company and the individual that they are allowed to use that data as they please?
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but I think the beginning of wisdom is to start with the facts, and the facts are that these companies are hugely successful because they provided a service people love.
Absolutely. And so the question, I think,
and if people, I mean, I'm told I have a Facebook page, but
you
I've
do.
Never, I can tell you I've never seen it.
Well, we had you on this podcast in part because you have a huge following. But an interesting counter would be, is how would you feel if that following was taken off by these social media companies?
That's the deplatforming debate.
Because they didn't like something that you said.
My first and honest answer is I wouldn't know.
That's the... No.
I mean... I literally wouldn't. I have no idea how many followers I've got.
So what do you? So what
I'm glad to learn from you.
You have a large following, but I mean, there are many. So conservative media companies, let's take these for example. They have. It's been proven that they've been deranked by Google, or they've been their business models are disproportionately affected by these social media companies.
I understand how irritating these people can be. Google, Abe Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And you will find that his political party was the National Union Party.
Right, not the Republican Party.
Not the Republican Party, because they ran on that for Civil War reasons in 64. But I understand how irritating it can be. But let me ask you another threshold question. If Facebook is behaving badly, is there ever going to be another Facebook, a rival Facebook? Or is Facebook the first human institution that is forever?
Facebook bought WhatsApp, and it bought Instagram because those were potential rivals to them. So the point here isn't that there couldn't be another Facebook. As you've pointed out, I can't see even 2 days into the future.
Yeah.
So we're not going to know 10 years. But the point, though, is that you have these clear effects and clear dangers and clear dynamics here in the moment. And once again, back to the theme when we finish up, is just that it seems like if you're a member of the Republican Party today, you're having to face the choice of whether or not these companies are regulated now. And that's just the difficult trend that we're just sort of seeing. This is the question that young members of the writer debate.
Fair enough. And the someone with a conservative sensibility says, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. The idea of preemptive regulations to prevent something that has not happened but might happen is dangerous. The idea that the government will know the unintended consequences of what it's about to do when it starts breaking these things up is dubious in my judgment. One of the first books that began turning me into a conservative, I read in the late 50s, it was The Affluent Society by John Kenneth Galbraith. And I said, when I put it down, I said, whatever else is true, this isn't. This is just not true that, for example, his argument was, the power of advertising is so enormous that large manufacturers can manufacture a demand for whatever they find it convenient to supply. Therefore, the law of supply and demand is repealed. Therefore, consumer sovereignty need not be respected because consumers are really not sovereign. They're playthings of advertisers. At exactly the time he published this, the Ford Motor Company put its entire marketing genius behind the Edsel, and it didn't work.
Never heard of it, which makes sense.
Precisely. Precisely. And Galbraith said in The Affluent Society, General Motors is so powerful that no one will ever successfully challenge its market share. Its market share is less than a third of what it was then. Galbraith looked into the future and got it wrong. He didn't anticipate, among other things, in 1958 or whenever it was that was published, he didn't anticipate a little thing called the Volkswagen Beetle and foreign cars and Toyotas and all that stuff, because the view from the Harvard Faculty Club wasn't perfect.
What's the difference between... So your point is, like, with the case of... All of the dangers we've pointed out about tech company power have been sort of preemptive, but aren't checks and balances in government preemptive, right? Why can't we apply that principle to this? Why can't we apply the thought of checks in the same way to this sphere?
First of all, there in the market, in the private sector, the great check is consumer sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And when people stop liking Facebook, things will change. Now, you may say Facebook is, the first absolutely unassailable monopoly in the history of human experience. I'm skeptical. Are you absolutely sure that 10 years from now, Facebook is going to be without a challenger?
No, I think there is definitely going to be a challenger in the next 10 years. The concern would be what happens over the next 2 or 3 years.
And also what happens in terms of competition. these companies have hundreds of billions of dollars because of what they've done. And in many cases, they're able, not in a way that a MySpace or a Friendster was able to buy out their competition, integrate those systems into their own companies. So how do you look, you talked about the salt and the protein. So when is monopoly antitrust policy to be put into place by the government?
When there are clear, measurable harms, not anticipated harms, not hypothetical harms, but actual harms. If you were a big stockholder in Sears Roebuck, you've been really harmed by Amazon. Who cares, frankly? If you were one of the 10,000 people working at 399 Borders bookstores, you've been harmed by Jeff Bezos. Sorry, that's life.
And I think this is the final question, or the final theme we want to strike on, which is when that anger at losing your job to a Jeff Bezos, when that anger at seeing the factory in your town close, or being told that you need to learn to code or to learn to work in a service sector job manifests, and you vote for President Trump in 2016, or you vote for a populist in the 2020 election, what is it about this book that gives a Republican or a conservative lawmaker the framework to answer that person's grievances?
And the answer is twofold. Mm-hmm. First is the system that produces results that you personally find injurious has been an enormous net benefit to the human race and to this country more than any other. Second, the costs of trying to prevent the dislocations and frictions that are unquestionably a part of this, the costs of this are stupendously high and incalculable, literally incalculable, because you cannot know where they stop. If you're going to, for example, have a government that is going to support basic research, and if you're going to have private sector equivalent of today's Bell Labs, someone had better produce a profit that is going to fund the research that will produce the profit-making products of tomorrow. That's what I'd tell them. There are no gains without pains, period. Adlai Stevenson said that as Democratic candidate in 1952. Still true.
Well, there we go. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Will.
Enjoyed
we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Conservative Sensibility, available on Amazon and wherever else you can buy a book.
Go to Borders.
Yeah, try and find a Borders.
Sagar here. Thanks for listening to episode 2 of The Realignment. If you enjoyed today's discussion, make sure you're subscribed and give us a 5-star rating. Next up, we dive into the rising tensions between Silicon Valley and populists on the left and the right. We'll be joined by Matt Stoller of the Open Markets Institute and Zachary Graves of the Lincoln Network. See you next week.